Hi, everybody. My name is Chris. I am an alcoholic. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be asked to do something like an Acts of Recovery. A lot of enthusiastic people show up at these events, and enthusiasm is something that is a grand quality to have when you're struggling your way into recovery. Enthusiasm can keep you going, get you through the rough spots. Want to thank the other speakers. I related so much to all of them. I'm going to have to sound redundant because there's so many similar experiences that I've had. But my topic today is being rocketed into the fourth dimension. For me to cover that, I'm going to have to talk about the three Chris dimensions that I was in prior to being rocketed into the fourth dimension, and they became quite grim toward the end. Like I said, I am an alcoholic. My first drink, I went into a blackout. I trashed the house. I was about 12. And I experienced the things that you experience when you're alcoholic and you drink. I experienced the phenomenon of craving, which is when you put one drink in your body, it asks for the second drink. And the second drink demands the third, and the third insists on the fourth. That's what happened to me the first time I started to drink. And I got to tell you, that's not what was happening to the two guys I was drinking with. They could have, you know, one and a half, and they were fine. That was never my experience. They also didn't go into a blackout like I did. So from the very, very get-go, I had an abnormal reaction to alcohol. But there was something that it did for me. I want to go back a little bit because this is one of the Chris dimensions, which is, I'll tell you a little story. One of the first memories that I can really remember that's indelibly etched into my mind is the day my mother came up to me and said, get your stuff together. It's first day of kindergarten. Okay, and I'm like, what? You know, and she says, like, I'm taking you in the car across town. You're going to kindergarten. You know, I'm a little confused about all this stuff. But I get in the car, and she drives me across town, and I can remember this like it was yesterday. She parks on the top of this hill, and down the hill, toward the bottom of the hill, was a school, and there's all these kids playing kickball and tag. They're all running around. They're already friends and everything, right? She lets me out of the car, closes the door, drives away, and I'm standing there up on the hill, looking down the hill, feeling like a dick. You know what I mean? I'm like, what if they don't like me? You know, what if I do something stupid? What if they make fun of me? Just horrible anxiety and self-centered fear. And, you know, obviously there's something wrong with me because they're all friends already and everything, right? So I know there's something wrong with me. So I go. I know. I just have to do it. I gotta pull myself together. I gotta be cool, you know. I gotta go do the kindergarten thing. And so, you know, I walked down the hill and I started the kindergarten thing, you know, with all that anxiety and that self-centered fear. Can I tell you what would have really helped? A pint of vodka. You know what I mean? A pint of vodka, I'd have been doing that kindergarten stuff, you know? I'd have been the kindergarten kid. Oh, I'd have been the funniest kid, and you know what I mean? Because that's what alcohol did for me. My problem was I didn't have any alcohol, and the drinking age at that time was 21. Okay, I was 5. That was a big problem. I couldn't get any alcohol. So I went through like the next like 7 years of school with that same self-centered fear, that same I was afraid to do oral reports in front of the class. You know, I was always just burdened with this overwhelming worry about what you're going to think about me, you know. And then I discovered alcohol that day with my two buddies. And I went into the blackout, and I learned about projectile vomiting. And I woke up in a field not knowing how I got there. Now, and I was ill. You know, that first real drunk where you poison yourself, and you have to stay horizontal for like 48 hours. And you know, that's what I did. But let me tell you, I slowly started to forget how ill it had made me. But I very, very distinctly remember and was able to hold on to the memory of what the alcohol did for me. It got rid of that fear, that self-conscious, always just anxious all the time. I was never comfortable with myself or my environment. I just never was. And for the first time in my life, after like drink number two, I was good. You know, I mean, I could step out. And I had no problems. So from that moment forward, I started to become preoccupied with alcohol. I started to become preoccupied with where I was going to get it, where I was going to drink it, who I was going to drink it with, where was the money coming from, what was it going to be, And I got real, real preoccupied with that. And I didn't become a daily drinker at age 12, but I became a weekend drinker. And, slowly the weekends would... you'd do a Wednesday here and there, and then a Tuesday, and a Monday, and a Thursday. And that happened slowly over the course of time. But I started to use alcohol with a very, very specific purpose. The purpose was to improve my spiritual condition, my emotional condition. I was not okay. Okay, I was not okay. I was holding it together because you had to be cool, but I was not okay. And when I drank for brief periods of time, I was okay. So I was using it strategically. Now, what happened was alcoholism, I guess like recovery, can be aggressive and quick, or it can be slow. It can be of the educational variety, or... and what happened with me was I drank for about 20 years. I love it when people come up and talk about being able to get into Alcoholics Anonymous at an early age. I would have qualified for AA at 12 because I showed all the signs of alcoholism, the blackout, the preoccupation, the phenomenon of craving. But how do you know what you don't know? I was stubborn. I was irresponsible. I was emotionally sensitive. I didn't like authority. If somebody told me to go left, I'd automatically go right, even if there was a cliff there. You know what I mean? It was just something that I just didn't want any advice. No, it's okay. I got it. So I held on. I held on like an idiot for like 20 years. And you got to understand, the first time I drank at age 12, I went into a blackout. And it got worse after that. You know what I mean? My drinking, because over any considerable period of time, your drinking will get worse. Your alcoholism will get worse. It's not going to get better. And so, I was stumbling my way through school. And I come from a period of time where... it was the late 60s, early 70s when I was starting to drink. So, there was a lot of, non-conference approved substances around. And I partook. I'll let you know that. You could have a pill in your hand and I'd grab it and I'd eat it. And then I'd go, what was that? Could have been a birth control pill or something. You know what I mean? I just didn't care. I wanted out. I wanted out. You know what I mean? I'm checking out. This is just too much. This is too much. This sobriety stuff. It's untenable. And I would do whatever you could do. I remember the Quaalude epidemic of 1972 in my school. This guy brings in a big sack of Aurora 714 Quaaludes. If anybody doesn't know what they are, you take a Quaalude, it's like drinking 2 6-packs of beer in 5 seconds, So this guy brings this big sack of Quaaludes in, and, he had got them way late the night before. He'd never done them, and so we go, oh, Quaaludes, great. What are they, and how many do you take? And the guy goes, I don't know, 3 or 4? So b- Before first period, about 50 of us ate like three or four Quaaludes before school. I'll just put it this way. The ambulance was back and forth all day long. And it got to third period, and I was walking down the hall, hanging onto the lockers. And I figured, you know, I gotta get out of here. I'm going to make a break for it, right? So I see the exit sign, and I start heading for it. And I bust through the doors, and I start heading for the woods. Okay? Now, not really thinking that the whole 400 wing can watch me out the windows of their classrooms. And they came up to me the next day and they said, "Chris, it was absolutely hysterical watching. You know, it took you something like 5 minutes to go 100 yards. You know?" I was like, I thought I was hauling ass, too. Another thing I did with a degree of regularity was total cars. I totaled 9 cars in drunken blackouts. I've been thrown out the front window, the passenger window. I even came to laying on the trunk of the car I was driving one time. I'd been thrown through the back window. That was crazy. The car spun around, hit a bridge abutment, and I was thrown out. I'm looking up at the stars, you know, and like, whoa, you know, this isn't good. And what do you do? You know, like what's the first reaction if you're an alcoholic? I'm going home, right? I'm going home. So I get back in the car. It's got 3 flat tires. There's not a window left in it. It's bent like a boomerang. Okay. And the drive shaft is slapping the frame. So I'm going whacking a boogada bam, whacking a boogada bam. Only like about 2 miles an hour, and I go right by a cop taking radar, okay? Much to his consternation. He didn't even have to pull me over. He, like, walked me over, you know? And he reaches through the window, and he starts shaking me, like, "Where did you have that accident?" I'm like, "What accident, officer?" Glasses flying out of my hair. The cops are always hassling me. And he goes, He goes, "Where are you going?" I go, "I'm going home." He goes, "Well, where's home?" I go, "Basking Ridge." He goes, "That's 28 miles. Are you nuts? You got no tires." You know, so once more, I get hassled by the cops. And that was my first DWI. Let me skip to my last DWI, okay? You're going to love this. Supposedly, I crossed a double yellow. You know how that is, right? Supposedly, I crossed the double yellow, and I get pulled over, and, you know, I roll down a window, and the cop goes, "License, registration, insurance card." So I'm reaching over into the glove compartment. I'm toasted, okay? I'm as drunk as a goat. And I'm, you know, and it's just, you know, I'm fumbling like 5 minutes, right? I'm fumbling. Finally, I just give up, and I scoop up the entire contents of the glove compartment and hand it to the cop, okay? There's like maps and combs and, you know, tissues, and a flashlight was in there, you know. And remember I told you cops were always hassling me, right? So he does some sobriety thing, like he looks in my eyes and you know, they like don't even move or something. So he takes me to the police station to do the sobriety test. Has anyone in here ever been filmed, you know, while doing a sobriety test? Okay, yeah, you know, listen, don't ever watch those. Okay, I'm warning you right now. You're going to need therapy if you do. You know, the next morning, hazy recollection. You remember hazy recollections of certain things? I go, you know, I nailed the ABCs in that test. I'm going to hire a lawyer, and I'm going to fight this. So that's what I did. I hired a $1,500 lawyer, real high-priced lawyer for, you know, 1983 or whatever. Hire this lawyer, and we're going to fight this, right? So the first thing we do is we go to the police station to you know, watch the video. We need to check this out. And the cop that gave the video to the lawyer was sniggering. He's like, that was not a good sign. You know, they must have been watching it during break, you know, for like the last 6 months. You know, it's like a bad Jerry Springer episode. But anyway, He puts it in the and all of a sudden the TV lights up, and there I am. I was horrified. Okay, I mean, if you've ever seen yourself, that it's disturbing to see yourself in that kind of a state. And we get, we get to the ABCs, and I did nail the ABCs. You know how I nailed them? Like this. A, B. I'm going, now this whole time the $1,500 lawyer is, he's very, very professional, okay? He's professional. And there's parts in it where I'm hanging onto the wall while I'm walking the line. You know, they make you walk the line, I'm hanging onto the wall. I mean, it's just horrible. I'm asking for a cigarette every 2 seconds. It's just pathetic. It's pathetic. And I'm like this. But here's the worst part. They get to the end of all these tests. They've made their point, okay? And they go, Mr. Schroeder, we're gonna turn the camera off. Is there anything you'd like to add before we turn the camera off? And I'm a little concerned. And sure enough, I look right over at the camera and I go, aah! Like this, right? The attorney drops to the floor in hysterics. He's like, aah! I've never seen anything like that. Aah! If we had any chance of beating this, you blew it. I walked for 4 years on that one, what I mean? I was expecting Jetson mobiles when I got my license back. But, these are all the problems. And, I had problems with work. Anybody ever have any problems with work? Your boss being a jerk, How many people in here don't have bosses that are jerks, it's typical. I come from a really smart family. My brother and sister are both college professor PhDs. My mother and father, Phi Beta Kappa. I graduated the second stupidest kid in the high school. I was really preoccupied with things, I was busy. I would take Wednesdays off, just to break up the week. The teacher would go, where's Chris? And somebody would go, it's Wednesday. Oh, that's right, it's his day off. So I wasn't applying myself, Did anybody ever tell you had a lot of potential? I'm one of the potential crowd. But anyway, I went to college. I had these great plans. Anybody a good starter in here? All right, I'll give you a friend. I always started really well. Man, I was cooking. And somewhere along the line, I would lose emphasis. I would lose enthusiasm to continue with the project. I would change my mind or something. I took guitar. I'm going to learn the guitar. I took 3 guitar lessons. I'm going to join the Boy Scouts. I went on 1 camp out. Okay, I went to college for 6 years. I got 4 credits. It was just like, I'd get to a point where I don't want to do that anymore, And so I ended up somewhere along the line becoming an electrician. And I was a bad one, okay? I electrocuted myself practically every day. It was brutal. My hair was sticking out. And, I would do really bad. I'd miscalculate where to drill down in somebody's house. I remember one time, I had to go down. My drill got caught, and there was stuff on the end of the bit. I had to go downstairs to the homeowner and have him open up his master bedroom closet. There was like 20 suits all covered with plaster. One of them coiled up into the ceiling, where I had caught it. Another time, this is so bizarre, but I swear to God, it's true. I'm working in a department store. This place is called Epstein's. It's like a Macy's or something. And we're doing the computer cash registers. So what I had to do is I had to loop data cable between cash registers. And right out in the middle of the floor in these places are cash registers. So I'd have to drill into the floor with this big drill with the big auger bit. And then I'd have to climb in the ceiling and pull cable. Well, this one day I'm doing the cash register in the lingerie section. Okay, now I'm preoccupied a little bit, it's just an interesting place to be working. And all of a sudden the drill catches on a metal beam after it goes through the floor. And it's one of those old, 12 horsepower big silver drills with the bar handles with the locking trigger. You remember those? They're illegal now, but that's what they gave me. And the trigger, I bear down on it. When it catches, the trigger locks, and it spins me around like this. It literally ties me up in the cord and then rips the pants right off my ass. And it finally unplugs from the wall, and I'm tied to the drill with no pants, going like this in the lingerie section, okay? Which is an issue when you have to be really cool like me, you know? And gotta really stretch to do that in that situation. You know, I mean, time and time again, there bad things would happen. Now, you know, I had lost a family. I'd lost my driver's license a whole number of times. I'd lost so many jobs, you know, it's ridiculous how many careers I started. I had very few friends left. The friends that were still with me toward the end of my drinking didn't really even have names. They were like Green Man and Weezer, you know. They had like aliases, you know. They were all dope fiend, you know, alcoholic type of friends who were, you know, really bad. My last girlfriend when I was drinking, I met during a prison pen pal thing that somebody had talked me into. And listen, I'm not recommending this if you're new or just coming back and you're lonely, you know. This did not work for me. She was like a career criminal, you know, like do you know what sociopaths are? They're people that have absolutely no remorse or guilt or any kind, you know, they just can do anything and it just doesn't matter. And I end up moving her back up to New Jersey to live with me and Mom. Okay? Oh, she always wanted to be armed, you know. I mean, this was really a bad move on my part, you know. It was, it didn't go well. I mean, so like my love life is not, I mean, if you look at the quality of my life was in the toilet toward the end, the last couple years of my drinking. Here's what it would look like. I would come to in the morning wearing the clothes that I had passed out in the night before, you know. I'd go, and I was a smoker too, you know, so I'd go into the bathroom and do my vomiting calisthenics, you know, and, you know, brush my teeth and then, you know, get out in the car and, you know, drive to work shattered. Because if you drink like a quart of whiskey or vodka, you know, the next day you're like, you're ringing, you know, you're like, you know, a Geiger counter would go off next to you. You know, you're just like, and I drive off to work. Now, if I'd get pulled over, I hadn't had a drink since like 8 o'clock the night before, I'd still get a DWI because it's coming out of my pores. It's coming out of my pores. You know what I mean? So I'd get to work and I'd had a bad electrical job, you know, and I'd go up to the boss. I'd go, well, what do you want me to do that? And he'd go, well, I want you to go here and do this and here and do that and here and do that. All right. I'd get in the truck. I'd get out of his driveway and I would have completely forgotten what the hell he told me to do. You know, and so I'd have to drive back in. What are you doing back here? What do you want me to do again? You know, God damn it, I told you to write things down. So he'd like yell at me. And like this whole time, I would be swearing to God I'm never going to drink again. You remember making those promises to yourself? I never want to feel this bad again. I never want to feel like this again. I'm like poisoned. I'm shattered. I can't go on like this. Today is the day I am going to quit drinking. I'm not drinking today, okay? Now, the thing is, I really meant it at like 9 in the morning. If you would have put a lie detector on me, you know, the guy doing the polygraph would have said, this kid's never drinking again. You're good. Because I meant it, you know. But here's what would happen. I'd rehydrate. You know how you'd have to get about a half a gallon of liquid down to rehydrate? I'd get maybe half a sandwich down at lunch, and I'd start to think, you know that position I took earlier this morning on never drinking again? That's a pretty strong position. Never, ever drinking again. That might need to be modified. And by 3 o'clock, 3:30, you know, 4 o'clock is quitting time, I will have modified that decision into going and buying a quart of vodka on the way home from work. I would get home, I'd buy it, you know. And listen, when I showed up in front of the guy, in front of the liquor store clerk, I might as well have been saying this.
hey, hurry up, hurry up. You know, ring me up fast. I'm sober. I'm sober. I need help with this. You know, will you hurry up? This is horrible. This is horrible. I need to get that. I need to get home. I need to start drinking. You know, get Mrs. McGillicuddy the hell out of the way with her goddamn white wine. You know, hurry it up. I mean, you know, this is what I'm thinking. And as soon as I get home, as soon as I crack the top off of it, it's like this. You know that feeling? Like, okay, all right. And I had these like 24-ounce glasses. I'd throw some ice in, and I'd take a little bit of Coke, like this, you know, and I just start drinking. And literally, I was drinking to overcome an obsession. You know what I mean? So I went from if you could call it sober at like 4:15. To knee-walking, tongue-chewing, not able to operate my own pants zipper drunk in about an hour and a half. You know what I mean? And I'd be like, and then I'd start calling people on the phone or something. You know what I mean? Did you ever call people up on the phone? Oh, man. I'd come down the next morning. I'd see the numbers. Like, oh, no, I called Mary Lou McGillicuddy from the eighth grade. Oh, no. I can just see it now, you know, Mary Lou, I love you, you know, like 2 a.m, you know, oh, so what I started to do was, when I started to, I knew I was going to do this, I was powerless over drunken dialing, so I started cutting the phone line, you know, I'd start to drive, cut the phone line, but I'm an electrician, right, so I'll fix the friggin' thing. And it got to the point where I tried to make it hard. I'd cut it next to a knot hole or something, you know. But I'd cut the electrical cord off the vacuum cleaner and pat, you know, just to patch it or whatever. And then I was cutting it way up at the top of the house. I'd throw a ladder up on the top of the house and cut the phone lines like way up at the top of the house. But I'd find some milk crate when I got drunk and I'd get up there and I'd fix it. It got so bad that I had to call the phone repair guy. It was like you'd pick up the phone and be like. So I go, my phone's not working, you know. So he comes over, and I'd never forget. He's looking. He's going, what the hell? He goes, it looks like somebody just cut this phone line in 35 places and scotch taped it back together. I even see a vacuum cleaner line on it. You know, I'm like, yeah, that's what I thought it was too. You know? Because you got to be cool, you know. So, I mean, my life is not going great. Okay, do you get some kind of a perspective about the three dimensions of, like, Chris's world? You know, like, I'm about, you know, I need to be rocketed into something. You know what I mean? This is, like, really bad. It's, you know, and listen, I'm a smart guy, you know. I'm a smart guy. I keep doing stupid things. Time and time again, I'm doing stupid things. And I'm kind of a nice guy. I, like, knew that inside, but I would do really mean things to people. It was getting to the point where I was starting to contemplate suicide. Here's an important statistic. The alcoholic is 60 times more likely to take their own life by suicide than the non-alcoholic. So be careful when you're getting life insurance and you got to check that box, okay? Because they know that. You know, all of a sudden your premium is going to be like 14 grand a month. But anyway, my life is like hell right now. What moves me toward, you know, here's what happens with all of us. We're going to have a separation experience. You know, the clouds of delusion will part for us to such a degree that we'll be able to see how much trouble we're really in. You know, we'll get a quick glimpse of just how bad things have really gotten. And then we sign ourselves into Happy Hills or you know, something. You know, we do something, you know. We go to the therapist, you know, whatever we do. We take some kind of action because we're desperately pushed toward that because we see, look, this is just getting worse and worse and worse. And mine was a situation happened at work. It shamed me, you know, like I could lose my family. I could lose my driver's license, you know, but being shamed was just something I just couldn't take anymore. So I signed myself in. to a rehab in my area, a 28-day program. You know, when I got sober, you couldn't shake a stick without hitting the 28-day programs. They were everywhere, you know. As soon as managed care came in 92, 600 of them closed up in like 1 month in America. But they were everywhere, you know, and I signed myself into this place. And I got to tell you, I wanted to separate from alcohol. I was desperate to separate from alcohol, okay? I wanted to stop, like more than anybody. And so I signed myself into this place, and I started to do the things that they asked me to do. Now, I've had the opportunity to begin to work with revolving around professional alcoholism and drug treatment, and I'm starting to really know what the hell is going on with that stuff. And this place that I got signed into was no great shakes. Okay, I didn't have one personal meeting with my counselor. What they would do is show us Father Martin movies and put us in group. Anybody ever been in group? That fun? They put you around a big circle and you each get to talk about how lousy your day is. Oh, my day's really, really lousy. And every once in a while, somebody would like hog the group time, and I'd get pissed. I'd have a resentment. Shut up! Would you just shut up? I'm tired of hearing it. Just shut up. I want to share. You know? And you'd wait until you got your turn, and you'd tell everybody how awful everything is. And, you know, listen, let me tell you, what I know about alcoholism today, trying to treat alcoholism with group is like trying to stop a semi with a cobweb, okay? You're going to a gunfight at the OK Corral with a Swiss Army knife, all right? It's not going to work. So I did group, and I got out of there. And here's what they told me. They go, you might want to go to AA. You might want to get a sponsor. You might want to get a home group, blah, blah, blah. You have to come back to outpatient. It's like, okay, I'll do the outpatient. So guess what outpatient is? Group. Okay? So I'm paying $85 a night to listen to this moron, you know, that I can't stand talk about how screwed up his family is. I wanted him to die. I did. Why don't you just drink? You know, so you get the hell out of here. You know, I mean, and I'm paying $85. I'm going to 2 AA meetings a week, and I'm 2 outpatients. What more do you people want? Okay? I mean, my God, you know, this is primetime TV night, you know? I mean, what more do you want? Paying money, you know? And I'm going to AA like it's a castor oil treatment. You know what I mean? I'm begrudgingly going in there. And you got to understand, I still got the scared kindergartner all over me, okay? I don't feel comfortable in the meetings. Oh, Chris, would you like to share? No, but I'm going to kill you after the meeting for suggesting it. You know, thank you very much. You're going to be looking for tires. Oh. I was a nut. But I thought I was addressing my alcoholism. I'm doing what they told me to do. Okay, I'm doing what they told me to do. One day, I'm on my way to an AA meeting. And the thought crosses my mind. Chris, you've been sober almost 90 days. You know what? You don't even really remember what it's like to be drunk. It's been so long. I'll bet if you bought a gallon of vodka and drank it, it would make you feel so bad that, number one, you'd remember what it's like to be drunk, because some idiot said if you can't remember your last drunk, you haven't had it. You know, so I took that literally. And number two, I would rush back into AA, and I'd be the AA kid. You know, I mean, I wasn't mixing well. You know, I thought that I'd do the things that I needed to do. So I drank a gallon of vodka to better improve my sobriety. Okay? Can I tell you that was a miscalculation? 3 drinks into it, I go, oh my God, what have I done? I've opened up the cage door of the beast. And the beast is going to move me around like a puppet, you know, for the next 6 months. Or however long, I'm dead. Why did I do this? Now, let me ask you something. Was I insane? Did the alcohol make me insane? My insanity came from a place of sobriety. My insanity came from a place of unrecovered alcoholism. All I was doing was showing up. You go to a bunch of PTA meetings, it doesn't make you a parent. You know what I mean? I'm going to a bunch of AA meetings, you know? You sit in a chicken coop, you're not going to become a chicken.
So I wasn't doing what you needed to do. Now, like 5 months later, you know, I come out of this and I've just threatened my entire family with a 38 caliber handgun. You know, I was going to kill them all. You know how it is. And it was Christmas, you know, and I was going to kill them, and it didn't go well. It talks about in a vision for you. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. You'll wish for the end. You know, you will wish for the end. And I did. I remember I started to go through the DTs. Anybody in here get the DTs ever? Oh, yeah, that's fun, isn't it? Oh, boy. Doing the fish flop, you know, completely insane. You want to talk about terror. So anyway, I'm like detoxing, and there's animals running around the room, and there's maggots all over me, and I'm hearing marching bands, and there's big animals like shaking the house to get in, you know, and I remember looking up at the ceiling, and a big demon came out of the ceiling to eat my face. Okay, this big ass demon, ah! You know, and I remember just looking up, and I go, ah, God help me. And it was a cry of help. What it was is I now can see that the level of humility that cry of help came from. You know, God hears those prayers when you come from that kind of a place of powerlessness and that kind of a place of humility. Man, I knew this thing was going to eat my face off. You know, and I just said, God, please get me sober or kill me. You know, I can't take this anymore. And you know, I haven't had a drink since that demon. I went back into Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that Happy Hills was not going to do it for me. You know, I didn't want any more goo. I'd had plenty of that, thank you. Oh, God. Hey, you wonder where the closed-minded discussion meetings come from that there are around, you know? Where do you think they came from? When there were 7,000 rehabs everywhere, and they were flowing everybody toward us. Oh, let's put a big circle around and talk about our day. We can do group. Oh. Anyway, not that I judge. I don't mean to cast dispersions. You know, if that's what your home group is like, you know, that's what it should be like. That's probably good. Oh, God. But anyway, I headed back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, I went back in with a 1976 Ford Granada with white walls and no clutch and no muffler and no heater, you know, and no parking brake, and it had orange paint inexplicably, you know, strewn throughout the passenger compartment. Never remembered how that got there. You know, and I struggle off to my first meeting, and here's what happened. I get into the meeting and I sit down. And you got to understand, I mean, the scared kindergartner is owning me. And I'm sitting there, you know, and all of a sudden somebody taps me on the shoulder and hands me a step book. So, okay, I grab the step book and they go, they're reading from step 12 on page 112 or whatever, right? And I look and I go, I figure it out. They're reading a paragraph or two and they're coming down the row at me. You know, I'm like, no, you know, so I get up and I leave. This, you know, I was going to have to read from a book. Do you understand? So I'm outside on the stoop and I'm having a cigarette and I'm thinking, oh, man, this is too much to say. This is way too much. I don't think I can take it. I don't think I can do it. So this guy, I'll never forget him. God bless him. I found out later he only had like 6 days himself. But he sees me leave and he comes out. His name was Jorge. And he comes out and he lights up a cigarette too. And he goes, hey, my name's Jorge. How you doing? What's your deal? And I said something to him like this. Oh, so my relapses of demons and maggots all over. He's horrible. He's trying to get here. No clutch. It was horrible. You know. And he goes, well, why don't you come on back into the meeting with me? And I go, well, there's a meeting tomorrow night. And there's a meeting tomorrow night that I'm going to go back in. And he goes, no, come on. Let's go inside. All right? And he knew what tomorrow meant, this guy. Even if he had 6 days, he knew what tomorrow meant. So I don't want to cause a scene. So I go in with him, and I sit down. We sit down right in the second row. And I'm sitting there like this, you know. And he leans over to him, and he goes, okay, now raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back. I'm like, well, there's a meeting tomorrow night. Everybody raises their hand. Everybody's coming back tomorrow night. He goes, no, raise your hand. He starts to get loud. So now listen, this is bad because people are starting to look at me. Okay? Any minute they're going to be thinking at me. I got to shut this guy up. So never seen this happen before, never seen it after. I shoot my hand up right in the middle of somebody sharing. Okay, this person sharing about their day or something, and I raise my hand, and the leader is like perplexed. The leader shuts the person up who's sharing and calls on me because, you know, they can see that this is some kind of big deal. So I was pretty profound, you know. I did it kind of like this. He's crazy. He's a relapse of heart. He's there with animals and the running around. It's just arrows and triple TTs. Thank you. And the room was just as quiet as can be, okay? And then all of a sudden, everybody starts going, yay! They're like cheering, yay! And I took it as acceptance, okay? I now know what it really is. It's like, you pathetic bastard, oh my God, I thought my day was bad. Thank you so much, oh! My problems are like nothing, you know? But I took it as acceptance, and here's what it was. There was like a wall of fear, that kindergartner wall of fear. You know, I couldn't go down the hill and play with the other kids. Raising my hand and telling everybody I was coming back knocked a big chunk of that down. And for the first time in my life, I felt a little hope. I may be able to survive this thing called alcoholism because it was checking me out. Now, rocketed into a fourth dimension of reality. Okay. I was rocketed into a fellowship tenable sobriety because I didn't know any better. This was North Jersey, 1988-89 AA, okay? Every single speaker that came up here talked about the actual mechanics, the actual working of the 12 steps. That's the recovery process, okay? During this period of time, there was what I will describe as the oral tradition version of AA. And that's where everybody sits around in a circle, like group, and they share things like my sponsor Harvey Gerbilfeather used to say, underneath every skirt's a slit. Thank you. You know. So there's like a whole lot of one-liners, you know, little cliches, you know, little wisdom sayings. And if you're new, you're like, what the hell? What does that mean? Upside down thinks. You know, easy does what? What does easy do? First things first, you know, what do you think I do? Seventh things first? What does that mean? Kid, you gotta hang on. Well, how do you do that? You let go. Now, what are you talking about? All right? Are you out of your mind? This is what AA was like in North Jersey at that time. So I'm going to meetings like a sumbitch, okay? I'm going to like 12 meetings a week, you know, I'm a secretary here, I'm a treasurer there, I'm making coffee over here. In North Jersey, you have these things called no-show GSR commitments, you know, so I was doing that. I was driving the boobies from the hatch, you know, to the meeting. I was doing that, going out to the diner. I'm the fellowship dude. I'm the pope of the fellowship, okay? But guess what? Guess who was still living in me? That scared kindergartner, okay? I still had anxiety. I still had remorse. I felt restless, irritable, discontented, pissed off most of the time, okay? Real guilty and remorseful and filled with shame, you know, and anxiety and sense of impending doom. But I'm going to meetings, okay? And how you doing, Chris? Great. You know? I mean, you can't really tell them. Well, I'm having these fantasies about killing myself and, you know, other people too, you know? And you know, I want to kill you. You know, how are you doing? I mean, you can't tell them. You can't be honest. They'd lock you up if you told them the truth, you know? So I'm great, fine, doing well. You know, I was like the tension in a garage door spring, you know, ready to break, you know? And one of my buddies, I'll never forget it, Radio Shack Mike handed me a set of tapes this one time, okay? And there were a set of tapes from a couple of guys from Arkansas who were doing a big book study. Now, he'd given me some tapes prior to that, so I was a little bit wary. He gave me some affirmation tapes. You ever do affirmation tapes, like in early sobriety? I tried it, okay? I don't recommend it for anybody. You're supposed to stand in front of the mirror and do something like this. You're supposed to say this 30 times or until you believe it. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, you're a wonderful guy. Chris, I'm a scumbag! You know? It's never going to work, okay? Those things work on non-alcoholics. Stay away from them. Anyway, so these were the tapes. I'm kind of skeptical, but I got a long ride to work. You know, I got my license back. So I start putting these in, and these are the Arkansas Big Book guys, okay? And the first thing that happens to me is I get a resentment. What the hell are they talking about? This isn't the way we do it in New Jersey. You know, but I start to listen. And listen, the truth will haunt you if you're an alcoholic. If somebody tells you the truth, it's going to haunt you. First, you know, first stage of truth, getting pissed at whoever's told it to you. Okay? You know it's like anger, bewilderment, acceptance, despair, you know, however that works. But when somebody tells you the truth, you know, first thing I did was I got resentful. Ah, they're from Arkansas. We do more thinking before 9 o'clock in New Jersey than they do in Arkansas. But the fact of the matter was these people saved my life. I was not hearing this in the meetings. What they had was they had an understanding of the mechanics, the actual mechanics of the recovery process. You know, I read the big book like it was the Da Vinci Code. Okay, done. And then it collected dust. Okay, it's a basic text of our fellowship. What do you do with a textbook? You got to study it. You got to do the problems. You got to do the exercises. You know, that's what you need to do with a textbook. Imagine going to calculus class and never reading the book or doing the problems. You just go there to share about calculus. Oh, yeah, calculus is great. I like calculus. I'm grateful that there's calculus. You know, you're never going to get past any of the problems. Or it's like going to the airport and then sitting in the terminal and talk about flying. Yeah, flying. Flying's great. Yeah, there goes a big one now. And you never get on the plane. You know, that's what's happening in Alcoholics Anonymous today. Oh, you're in AA? Yeah. Oh, it's a 12-step fellowship. You ever do the steps? No. What? You know? And that's what was happening in North Jersey. Now, this is what Joe and Charlie exposed me to. They exposed me to the actual practical mechanics of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I did was, I put it aside for a while I dealt with my resentment. But some things happened in my life where I had a sober bottom. Anybody ever have like a sober bottom? You know, you go in the barrel, like three terrible things go wrong at the same time, and you're like, ooh. And that happened to me. And I just remember being desperate to feel good, to feel okay. That's why I drank. But I knew drinking was going to take me right back to that demon in the ceiling. I just knew I couldn't do that. But I was like unrecovered. I was like, you know, just shattered, just in so much trouble, emotional pain like you would believe. I don't think people outside of this room can get near that kind of loneliness and emotional pain that we can. But I got to that spot at about a year and a half sober. And it was either put a bullet through my head, drink a gallon of vodka, or do something. I didn't know what. I took these tapes back out, and I started listening to them, and I opened up a big book next to them. And when it said, we put these people down in black and white, I put them down in black and white. I did the inventories to the best of my ability at that time, which wasn't really great because I wasn't really being guided. I was learning from the steps. But I did a fear inventory. I did a harms to others emphasis on sex. I did the four-column resentment inventory. I really looked at where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid. I started to look at all this stuff. And, you know, I started to move on through the steps to the best of my ability. Now, something very significant started to happen to me during this process. Back to the scared kindergartner. All of a sudden, he started to heal. All of a sudden, I started to feel okay about myself. All of a sudden, I was started to not care as much about what I thought you thought about me. Okay? I started to heal emotionally and spiritually with the work from these steps. And, you know, you get through the steps the first time, and you know the first thing you want to do when you go back to the AA meeting? Why didn't you tell me? You're trying to kill me? You know? So I became like, you know, a big book evangelist for a while. It's in here, it's in a book! You know? And because that's what usually happens when you find the recovery process. You're anxious to let these idiots know that are still doing group. But an even more significant thing happened. Even more significant thing happened for me. I had been sponsoring around this time because you give good share and you can get sponsees. Okay? You can have your head up your butt, but if you give good share, you'll get some sponsees. So I was towing around, a crew of guys, and they were drinking on me. You ever have sponsees drink on you? Make you look bad? You know what I mean? Somebody will come up to you and they'll go, "Is Harry yours? Do you know he's drinking and he's hitting on the new women?" "Yeah, Harry's mine. I'll talk to him." Yeah. So I had a bunch of these losers that I was sponsoring. And I said, I'm going to do something desperate. I'm going to bring them over to my house and we're going to go through the big book, just like the Joe and Charlie tapes. Now, let me tell you something. You want to really learn something? Teach it. That is the absolute best way to learn anything. Become a teacher of what you want to learn. I'm starting to take all these guys through the big book, line by line, exercise by exercise. And here's what I found that was very, very significant. Out of the people that have gone through the book with me, there's many hundreds by this time, the people who did the fourth and fifth step holding nothing back, did the 8 and 9, made all their amends to the best of their ability, except when to do so would injure them or others, and then started to work with other alcoholics living in 10, 11, and 12. Every single one of those guys is still in AA. Every single one of those guys is still working with people, and the quality of their life is out the roof. They have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of reality. You want to get rocketed into the fourth dimension of reality? It's easy. And it works for every single person that tries it. Each one of the spiritual exercises in the book Alcoholics Anonymous has a result, a spiritual result, a set of promises or a consequence. Okay, there's some promises in the book that are negative promises too. But if you follow to the best of your ability the recovery process that's outlined in the book, you can experience a little bit of the fourth dimension. One of the things it asks in the big book is, ask yourself what the spiritual concepts mean to you. The great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is we do not want to pin all kinds of attributes on your higher power. We don't want to tell you what kind of a higher power to have. We don't want to get involved in that. That needs to be personal. You need to really buy into that, so you need to develop it yourself. We will tell you this, that if you don't get a higher power, you're going to die. We'll tell you that, but we're not going to paint the picture of your higher power, you know? Now, when you go through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you get a conscious contact with a higher power. Once you have a conscious contact with a higher power, you start to develop an intuitive sixth sense. The sixth sense where you really already know the answer. An unrecovered alcoholic already knows the answer. He just does the opposite anyway. You know what I mean? You don't want to talk to your sponsor about it because he'll tell you to do the right thing. You know what I mean? When you start to get contact with a higher power, what you start to do is you start to develop that sixth sense, that intuition. Intuition basically is knowing without conscious thought. And you start to follow that intuition. And you start to live in the realm of the spirit in that way. And here's what happens. I can tell you from my own personal experience, things get better, okay? Now, I'm not saying we don't go through rough times. I'm not saying we don't get put in the barrel or have our challenges. We do. But how we respond to them changes. Life is a struggle, okay? Every day we struggle with this thing called life. But when we get to a point where we're recovered, we can engage in the struggle of life without struggling. Does that make any sense? I've had some challenges like you wouldn't even believe, and I've been cool with them. And by being cool with them, I can be appropriate and the most productive and the most support to that problem that I can be without it being about me. Like when I was drinking and I'd have to go to a funeral, the guy died on me. I got to get dressed up. You know what I mean? Like it's a different... Here's what rocketed into the fourth dimension of reality really is. As alcoholics, we've built a foundation, a life system foundation, built on selfishness and self-centeredness. Okay, it's all about us. We are a planet unto ourselves, and everybody else is just a satellite orbiting us. And, you know, how they benefit us is how often we get involved with them. You know, what are you going to do for me? So we're like alone, we're separate, and we're selfish, and we're self-centered. That's what we built the foundation of our lives on, the perceptions that we have. When we go through the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, we shift our perception from one of selfishness and self-centeredness to one of love and service. Now, the crazy thing is that if you want to really be happy, you would think that the more selfish you are, the more happy you would be, right? That's not true. The more you live in the realm of love and service, the happier you are. That's something I missed in kindergarten. You know what I mean? When they told you to share and not hit and all those things. I forgot. I didn't pay attention that day or something. I was always daydreaming. But these are spiritual principles that have been around a billion years. What Alcoholics Anonymous is it's spiritual living 101. Our problem is alcoholism. The solution to alcoholism is spiritual living. You start to live spiritually, spiritual things will happen to you. You start to act in a positive way, positive things are going to happen to you. It's cause and effect. It's the way the universe works. The universe is actually a very, very generous place. You know, I thought I was on the battlefield, like every minute of the day, you know, they're out to get me, those bastards, you know? It's not that way. It's not that way. The universe is a very, very generous place. It's a shift in perception is what the fourth dimension of reality is. You know, if you're new or you're coming back and, you know, you've been having problems with personal relationships and you've been having trouble at work and your family doesn't understand you and it seems like the cops are really vindictive. And you've got good motives. You always end up just kind of doing something stupid. You know, but alcohol's not really, really your problem. You know, your case is different. You know, if you're that way here tonight, welcome. Okay? That's the requirement for membership. It really is, being different. I had a great time down here today. Thank you all for hanging in here.